Please call the case.
Case number SCWC-14-1143, State v. Christoff. Arguing for the petitioner, Mr. William Lee. Arguing for respondent, Ms. Lauren Thomas, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney. Argument on the merits.
All right. Good morning, Mr. Lee and Ms. Thomas. Are you both ready to proceed today? All right. And Mr. Lee, we'll give you reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal, so we'll have a warning light come on at that point. And Ms. Thomas will give you a warning with 10 minutes to go in your argument. Mr. Lee, please proceed.
Thank you. Good morning. Jackson Christoff, he has pled guilty to murder in the second degree, but he was under a special disadvantage or disability of not speaking English. Now, that particular phrase, special disadvantage or disability, that's from a case of State versus Gomez. Admittedly, I did not cite that in my brief, but for the record, that's 130 Hawaii 465, 312 Pacific 3rd, 897. And I did give a copy of this case to Ms. Thomas this morning. That case is a little bit different as a waiver of jury trial, but that defendant waived jury trial with a Spanish interpreter. And a couple of points that should apply in this kind of analysis is that language barrier between the court and the defendant is a salient fact that should give notice to the trial court that the defense waiver may be less than knowing and voluntary, and also to analyze whether the waiver is knowing and voluntary, the court should take into account the defendant's background, experience, and conduct. Now, this is not a waiver jury trial. It's more than that. This was Mr. Christoff waiving his right to a jury and to trial and to appeal, and he was convicted of murder in the second degree. In this case, there is some evidence in the record as far as Mr. Christoff's background. He was a 22-year-old at the time of the change of plea. True key speaker, no indication how long he'd been in the country. 10th grade education. The circuit court mentioned young adult sentencing if the charge was something other than murder. So his exposure to the criminal justice system at the time was minimal. And his own attorney at the time testified that he's not sophisticated enough to understand a legal document. And so these are, I would suggest to this court, salient facts that should have given the circuit court notice that with this particular defendant, there's a risk that his plea might be less than knowing and voluntary. And
Mr. Lee, with that in mind, how would you describe the way the colloquy should have gone if there had been adequate recognition of the language problem of the defendant?
Well, the colloquy as it is now was a series of questions that elicited yes or no answers. And this was brought up by the defendant in Gomez Lobato as a suggestive way of conducting a colloquy to ask questions that would elicit more than a yes or no question. I'll cite another case, State versus Friedman, 93 Hawaii 63, 996 Pacific 2nd, 268. And I'd also given a copy of that to Ms. Thomas. Friedman was another waiver jury trial case. And in that case, the trial court had asked the defendant to explain to the court what a jury trial was. Instead of just reciting it, the court asked the defendant to explain it, and the defendant did explain his understanding of a jury trial. And with that, the waiver of the jury trial was upheld in that case. And so I would suggest that in this particular case, the circuit court could have asked questions of Mr. Christoff. Mr. Christoff, explain to me what the charge is. Mr. Christoff, explain to me what the maximum penalty is, and tell me some of your rights.
Well, even if that would be a better practice, in this case, didn't the circuit court hold a hearing where it had testimony from the defendant, from his lawyer, as well as from the interpreter, and based on those, on that testimony, made findings regarding the credibility of the defendant's arguments that he didn't understand, and in fact found, in essence, that the defendant did understand what he was doing. Now, are you asking us to find that those on what basis would you have us overturn the circuit court's credibility determinations and other determinations in assessing the evidence in this case? Again, realizing that it might be better practice to have asked open-ended questions, nevertheless, the question is whether the waiver was voluntary and knowing, and how, in your view, or why should we set aside those findings?
Well, in this case, I will point out that the circuit court, in its findings of fact and conclusions of law, and the order denying the motion, did not take into account Mr. Kristoff's background or education or experience with the criminal justice system. That was not addressed. Admittedly, it wasn't addressed by the parties either, but it was not addressed by the circuit court at that level. And so that is my argument that this was an abuse of discretion, where if the circuit court had addressed those factors and still found that Mr. Kristoff submitted his guilty plea knowingly and voluntarily, then it's a different question, but it was not taken into account. And the circuit court relied heavily.
Well, isn't who had the burden on the hearing? Isn't the burden on the defendant in the hearing?
Yes, on the defendant to provide a fair and just reason to withdraw his plea.
So if there wasn't information or the argument wasn't made about background and education, was that the defendant's responsibility to raise that? Or is it your view that was the court's responsibility to do it sua sponte, or the state should have raised it?
Well, my position is that under Rule 11, the trial court has the duty to ensure that the guilty plea is knowing and voluntary. And considering the language from Gomez-Lobato, it's relevant to the analysis as far as taking into account non-English speakers' education and background. And
I'm trying to understand. Are you saying the colloquy was deficient because those matters weren't adequately raised, or are you saying the trial court's finding that there was a knowing and voluntary waiver was suspect because the trial court didn't consider those factors?
I would argue both, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. I would argue that the colloquy itself is deficient.
And how is it deficient?
Well, it's deficient. I've already mentioned the series of questions that elicited yes or no answers. I count at least 30 of those questions.
And what wasn't asked?
What wasn't asked, I would propose that the court should have asked the defendant to explain.
Well, actually, in State versus Vitoge, 59 Hawaii 592, this court discussed a guilty plea, referred to Boykin versus Alabama, the 1962 United States Supreme Court decision, indicating that the United States Supreme Court made it very clear that the waivers must be explicitly shown on the record. And with respect to acceptance of guilty pleas, the waiver of several important federal constitutional rights must be on the record, including the right against self-incrimination. I've reviewed the transcript. Can you see anywhere where the court covers the right or discusses the right against self-incrimination? Why don't you look at it and let us know when you come back during your rebuttal? But I'm sure I'm raising the question now because I can't find it, so to give the state an opportunity to address that issue also.
Well, and that is also, I believe it's not addressed, although the court on page 9 of that transcript of the colloquy did inform Mr. Kristoff that he has the right to testify.
He says he had the right to testify, but he never says you have the right not to testify.
Exactly.
And that you cannot be forced to testify.
Exactly, and that does not appear in the transcript as far as the refusal to testify not being held against him in the trial.
Well, did he at any point in the proceedings during it suggest that that was a factor, that he felt he'd been misled on that grounds and that he would have done something differently?
No, it was not suggested by the defendant at that time.
Mr. Lee, don't we have a duty, both as an appellate court, to ensure that there's an affirmative showing on the record that there's an intelligent and knowing waiver of one's trial rights. Isn't that our duty?
Yes, that is my position.
Now, in this case, in addition to what Justice McKenna said, is there any place on this where the judge informs the defendant that he has a right not only to a jury trial, but he has a right to a bench trial? Is there any indication whatsoever? That's a pretty important right in this jurisdiction.
And not explicitly a bench trial. He does inform Mr. Kristoff that he has a right to a jury and that he has a right to have the government prove the case.
But to have, you know, somebody who's from a different country may prefer not to be judged by 12 people. And in fact, when he's told about 12 people, what the judge tells him is the judge tells him that what a jury trial is 12 people from the community who are randomly selected. It was always my thought that a defendant is able to help their lawyer pick those 12 people. So it looks like to me, I'm not so sure that the court properly informed him what the jury trial would be composed of in the case. I have some other concerns. There's the judge tells him that he's bound. Does the judge ever talk to him about the Hawaii Paroling Authority, that they're not bound by the 15 years that's been agreed to?
No, that does not appear in the transcript.
And that's probably the most essential portion of this plea agreement, and the defendant is never told that the HPA is not bound by what's occurring.
Perhaps it would be a better practice if
the court tells him that he has a right to pretrial motions, and what the court says is you have a right to for a pretrial motion to challenge the charge. Is that the only kind of pretrial motions that the defendant is giving up?
Well, in practice, it's not the only kind of pretrial motion he's giving up, but that's the only one that the court mentioned.
The court tells him that the jury listens to the evidence, and the jury decides if the evidence is sufficient to find you guilty. Is sufficient the standard that our courts use and our jury use?
Oh, of course not. It's proof beyond a reasonable doubt.
Is proof beyond a reasonable doubt ever mentioned in the colloquy?
I don't believe so. No.
Does the court ever tell him that a jury has to be unanimous?
There is no mention of that either. I agree with that.
Does he inform in terms of the jury, does he say that you have a right to help select that jury?
There is no mention of that as far as assisting in the jury selection process.
Basically, the judge in this case relied, he said, did your attorney tell you all, explain the charge to you? Did he explain everything to you, correct?
Correct, yes.
Right. And then when you review the interpreter's testimony, he said, and when he was asked during the hearing on the motion to withdraw guilty plea, he made it fairly clear on page 28 that when Mr. Harada was going over the form in the guilty plea form, which he signed at the prison, that he did not actually do a site translation, that all he did was explain what Mr. Harada had said, was saying. Sometimes for other defendants, he does a actual site translation of the entire document, the guilty plea form. But in this case, he did not do it. Isn't that what he said?
Correct. He interpreted what his attorney told Mr. Kristoff about the form.
Right.
But it was not a line-for-line translation of the change of plea form.
Right.
And so that was something else that the circuit court should have considered. And going back to the rights, the circuit court goes over, and referring to pages 8 and 9 of the colloquy transcript, in two paragraphs, that's about half a page, he goes over the right to file motions.
Can I come back to the last point? There was a finding of fact that Mr. Solander testified that the defendant understood his translations and that he specifically went over the change of plea form line by line with the defendant. Now, did you challenge that finding of fact? It's finding of fact 37.
Well, no, that's the interpreter's testimony.
But that's a finding. So you think that's not an actual finding by the court, then?
Well, the interpreter testified that way, so I have no doubt that he testified. Mm-hmm. But as far as whether...
Where did the interpreter testify that he went over it line by line? In other words, that's what the judge found, but where did the... But you didn't challenge that finding, but where did the interpreter so testify? The interpreter said, I interpret what was said to the defendant at the, when Mr. Harada talked, then I did it verbatim to the defendant, Mr. Kristoff. Okay, so what you were doing was interpretation as opposed to a translation. You know, sometimes I did that, not necessarily with the defendant, but maybe other clients. Actually, this is quite confusing, isn't it?
From my understanding, just your position is that that's not a finding by the court. That's just a recitation or a finding of what actually happened. It's just a recitation of the testimony. Is that correct?
Correct. The court is stating what the testimony was, and I think under that interpretation, I did not contest that finding.
Can I ask about another advisement? The Justice McKenna mentioned that this actually doesn't even seem to satisfy the guilty verdict here, doesn't even seem, the guilty plea doesn't even seem to satisfy Tachibana if there had been a trial, because there's no advice as to the person's right not to testify and that if he decides not to testify, it won't be utilized against him. But I'm even concerned with the way the judge informed him of his right to testify. What the judge says, you have a right to testify in your own behalf or have Mr. Harada bring witnesses for you to testify for you. I had always thought that a person had the right to do both if they wanted to, that they could testify and have witnesses. That's not what the judge said, though.
Those rights are not mutually exclusive. And the way it's phrased in the colloquy, it could be interpreted that way by some defendants, that those rights are mutually exclusive.
And we don't even know. I mean, the judge, normally when someone speaks English, we ask the person if they can read or write, and we're told that they can, which gives us some information about their level of education. Here we found out that he went to 10th grade, I think, where he's asked whether he reads or writes in the English language, but they never even asked him if he reads or writes in his own language.
No, that did not come up. I agree with that.
Mr. Lee. Since we're discussing the colloquy, I wanted to get your view about, in particular, in judging this colloquy, are we applying a more liberal standard as to whether the defendant should be able to withdraw his plea than we would if he had already been sentenced?
Yes, I am asking the court to apply that standard. The motion was
made. All right. With that understood, I'm interested in your thoughts about this information that the judge gave to the defendant that seems to, in line with this liberal standard, suggest that he might be able to just change his mind anyways. So let me read this to you. The judge says, do you understand that after you are sentenced, says after you are sentenced, not after you plead guilty, but do you understand that after you are sentenced, you cannot change your mind and say that I didn't like the sentence, so therefore I want my trial. And then the defendant says yes. So my question is, when you're looking at the record, was this an indication to the defendant that perhaps he could change his mind before he is sentenced?
It could be interpreted that way. I'm sure that wasn't the circuit court's intent.
Well, did the defendant ever indicate that in the record in any way that He was seeking to withdraw his plea because he felt he'd been misled by the court on that grounds.
No, no. The defendant raised issues with being pressured. He felt he was being pressured by the interpreter.
To just take the deal, right?
Take the deal, just to say yes or no. And so at that level, the defendant did not raise that particular point.
Can I ask you something along that line? I thought it was pretty interesting the way the judge asked him if he was satisfied with the legal services he received. No, you know, instead of the question being, are you satisfied with the legal services that you received, as I recall, it starts out with a statement saying, your attorney is a very fine attorney or something like that, and then saying, are you satisfied with the person's service? I think when you're speaking to someone of his age, of a non-English speaker, one could perhaps infer or even speculate that a question phrased in that way may not elicit an answer totally without any sort of undue persuasion.
Well, I would suggest that that kind of question usually suggests the answer. It's very rare for someone to tell the court, no, I'm not satisfied with my attorney, when they are entering a guilty plea. And so that in and of itself, it would not indicate that this plea was given knowingly and voluntarily.
Well, in coming back to the point I asked you about earlier, in conclusion of law 22, the court says the evidence presented at the hearing established that on April 9th, Mr. Harada, through Mr. Solander, went over the change of plea form line by line with the defendant. So again, is it your position that the court clearly erred, I guess, and that actually might be characterized as a finding of fact, and that the record doesn't support that finding? I'm trying to understand your position.
Defender had went over the change of plea form. The interpreter interpreted what the attorney told the defendant about the form.
Line by line, that's the finding here, correct? Although denominated a conclusion of law. 22. Established that on April 9th, Mr. Harada, through Mr. Solander, went over the change of plea form line by line with the defendant at the Oahu Community Correctional Center. And that's, the court found that that's inconsistent with the position that the defendant initially raised in his motion, which was that he was not aware that he was changing his plea to guilty before he came to the hearing on the 23rd. The court went through, made findings about what had happened in this instance, and then found that the defendant, in essence, was not credible. How is it your position that we should, in essence, overrule or disagree with those credibility determinations? Don't we ordinarily owe deference to the trial court's credibility determinations, which, after all, were made here after a hearing on the record with three witnesses?
And yes, the standard is abuse of discretion, and that is the legal standard here. Well, first, I will note that the public defender did testify. He went over the form line by line, and that is in the transcript.
And the court so found.
And the court found that, yes, I agree. And I would also agree that there is contradiction in the evidence presented before the court in the testimony from the defendant and his interpreter and his attorney. And the court is free to make credibility determinations. Aside from credibility determinations, my position is that this colloquy is still deficient.
Well, actually, doesn't our law, isn't Vitoke very clear that the record must affirmatively show that the plea was voluntary? And in that case, they talked about he wasn't informed of the charges against him. The record has to show that he was informed of the charges against him, the consequences of a conviction, constitutional rights waived by entering the guilty plea. And that, you know, in that case, it was an interpreter case, too. So in view of the potential language barrier, this court said that the court should have been aware of a possible misunderstanding and had made an effort to determine that the defendant had actually understood. But in terms of the, for example, the record has to show that he was informed of the charges against him. In the change of plea colloquy, all the judge asks is, did Mr. Harada explain to you the charge of murder in the second degree? Did he tell you what type of evidence the prosecutor has in this case, what's in the police reports? Did he tell you what possible defenses you may have to the charge? And assuming, and I agree, there is, I think, sufficient evidence for the judge's finding that Mr. Harada went over the guilty plea form line by line. But even assuming so, where is there, and in the hearing on the motion to withdraw a guilty plea, there's no testimony from Mr. Harada as to what he explained as to the nature of the charges or the defenses. The guilty plea form just says this is the charge, murder in the second degree. Does that explain what the charge is? Does that explain what the potential defenses are? Doesn't the law require that the record affirmatively show that the proper colloquy was done? In other words, a judge cannot just say, did the lawyer explain it to you? And without the lawyer saying what he explained, that's insufficient.
Well,
do you disagree with that?
No, I do not. And in this case, it seemed like the court relied on the fact that Mr. Kristoff was represented. And so there was a presumption that...
Especially in a murder change of plea. I mean, it should be done for every case, but we know that as a practical matter, for example, in district court on some of these minor cases, the judges will... They don't go through everything. But in a murder with a non-English-speaking defendant with a 10th grade education, is this sufficient?
My position is that it is not. I mean, you can look at the four corners of the transcript, and it appears that the circuit court went over what's required of Rule 11, but then when you take into account this person's background and his lack of education, then there are some real problems that arise in this case. And a serious question as far as whether he did in fact understand what was going on.
Well, you know, when I look back at how the judge explained, not only did the judge not tell him that the agreement that he made with the government regarding the minimum service, time he'll serve, wasn't something that was in the court's control, even though the court said it would be bound. But this is how the judge explains it. It says that both you and the state agree that you'll serve 15 years as a minimum sentence before you can be considered for parole, indicating, you know, that seems to say that that's what the minimum sentence will be by the HPA. And actually, HPA makes, of course, its own decision, and the plea agreement accurately says both parties stipulate and agree that they'll jointly recommend 15 years as the minimum sentence.
It might give the impression that will be the minimum that Mr. Kristoff will receive, but yes, as a technical matter, the plea agreement was that the government would recommend 15 years as the minimum.
It's not technical, it was the very foundation of what this person pled guilty.
Yes, and then it's up to the paroling authority to set the minimum as they wish. And that finer point was not explained to Mr. Kristoff, at least in the transcript at the time of the hearing. If there's no more questions at this time, I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney Lauren Thomas on behalf of the state.
I'm going to get to the sufficiency of the colloquy by the judge, because I'm aware, reviewing the case, that that is the core concern, and that's been confirmed by the court's questions today. But what I do have a concern, and I want to point out, is that that issue was never brought before the trial judge. Now, that's just simply, to put it simply, it's not fair. If you're going to come to the court and ask and base your motion on an error, shouldn't the judge address that error? And he did. He did, because all along the concern below and before the ICA has always been about the pressure that Mr. Harada exerted on the defendant. And in all fairness to Mr. Harada, that is essentially calling him ineffective, because there is enough, as we all recognize, it's in this room as well, there's enough inherent pressure within the criminal justice system that it is improper for a defense attorney or a prosecutor to exert pressure on a defendant.
I'm a little bit unclear about that. Let's assume that Mr. Harada did a very good job, but that the judge's colloquy was inadequate. Then that wouldn't really call into question Mr. Harada's performance, would it?
No, Your Honor. My point is that I think they skirted that issue. I think if you look at defendant's letter, that letter he sent to the court, he's talking about pressure by Mr. Harada, and that he didn't understand things because Mr. Harada didn't explain them to them.
Well, putting aside that, then, do you concede that this colloquy was insufficient under our law?
No, I don't, Your Honor.
All right. Where is the – can you alert me to where the right against self-incrimination was?
The right against self-incrimination, and I know that comes from Boykin. There's those three concerns that a lot of courts or parties refer to as the three Boykin rights. Which is privilege against self-incrimination. The second one is right to a jury trial. And the third one is the confrontation of one's accusers. Those were the rights that the Boykin court addressed. And there was no record in Boykin. That was 1969. I think the plea was much older than that. So there was no record at all. And we're all aware today that there's no record. The presumption is with the defendant, and it's basically
right. So this is the defendant's burden. Right. We recognize
now,
that. So where is
the privilege against self-incrimination is in the change of plea form. And I don't think the U.S. Supreme Court, as far as I'm aware, has never said, and I think they clarified maybe in McCarthy and maybe some subsequent cases like Henderson, that we never said that the judge has to say those words. But it has to be communicated to the defendant. He has to understand it, know it, and understand and make an intelligent waiver of that.
Could
and
I
that
ask you,
can come through a change of plea form. Which
can I ask you about that proposition,
yes.
The obligation of the court versus the change of plea form? The change of plea form, you rightfully point out, is pretty complete. But I'm sure you're not suggesting that the judge simply has to say to a 10th grade educated 22-year-old with a language problem, do you understand the form? Did your attorney go over the form with you? Thank you very much. Right? I mean, there's more than that. And in line with what Justice McKenna was discussing, the focus on the Fifth Amendment, I wanted to get your thoughts on it because it does seem to be a pretty powerful theme. There's a very interesting case, Wong versus Among, which was the first one to really focus on Boykin, but that was a case in which the Supreme Court assigned Circuit Court Judge Lum to go to San Quentin and conduct a hearing in response to a habeas corpus petition. And he reported back to the court and said, among other things, that the colloquy didn't reflect the Fifth Amendment analysis. And then the case that Justice McKenna was mentioning, State versus Vitoghi, Justice Richardson's case in 1978, not only talked about the Fifth Amendment, but also that the significance of not questioning the defendant about the Fifth Amendment was especially important because there was a language problem there. So if you combine that, and I might say that Judge Lim, in one of his classic cases, State versus Topozna, found that there actually wasn't a reason to withdraw the plea. And that was in large part because he had an extended discussion about the Fifth Amendment because he was informed of his Fifth Amendment rights. So it brings me back to my question to you. Do you really think that given our case law and the language problem and the age of the defendant that it's enough to just rely upon the form rather than have the judge question about it?
Well, Justice Wilson, I think it comes down to, again, the courts, and this court has said repeatedly that there's not specific words that need to be said or you must ask 1 through 10, but there is certainly a guidance, and the courts, and I know this court
okay.
is implored
I mean,
the lower
if,
courts.
If your so. Position is that in this case it just wasn't really necessary to inform the defendant about the Fifth Amendment right that he had, then I can understand that, but is that your position?
His rights, as I understand it in this case, were that the judge informed him of right to confrontation, compulsory process. He didn't use the word self-incrimination, but I would submit to the court that the defendant was informed of that and has never suggested to this court, except for maybe today, that he didn't understand those rights. So up until this point, and of course, when we prepare for these, we prepare for the court looking for plain error that's more than what defendant has raised.
Well, we could assume that he understood a right that he wasn't told about. That would be one way to approach it, but is that what you're suggesting?
My point my position is that it's in the guilty plea form, and Mr. Harada went over this form with the interpreter.
Did the judge ask that?
He did.
Ask Mr. Kristoff whether he understood the form?
I believe he answered that his attorney went over it with him and he understood what his attorney explained to him.
Ms. Thomas, yes. I'm wondering if relying on the form, relying on a defense lawyer going on the form is enough in light of our case law. Let me just read one sentence this is from the Solomon case, it's 107 Hawaii. In determining the voluntariness of a defendant's proffered guilty plea, the trial court should make an affirmative showing by an on-the-record colloquy between the court and the defendant where the defendant is shown to have a full understanding of what the plea of guilty connotes and its consequences. I wonder if that's satisfied by what we're looking at today. And
well,
I understand, I want to note that I understand your position, but the court also has this other requirement that we need to ensure that the guilty pleas satisfy our Constitution and our law.
I understand, Your Honor. And I guess I would answer that this way, because the state's aware that the court views the totality of the circumstances. It's a question of constitutional law, so you're going to review it de novo. And, you know, in my review of a lot of cases on these issues, it became apparent to me that not only you're not requiring a specific litany, but that some of these things can be satisfied through the change of plea form and competent counsel. Now, their only claim against their counsel has been that he pressured him. And then when Mr. Burks filed his motion to withdraw, for some reason he dropped that pressure and he was blaming the interpreter. And through my preparation for this case, I know there are ethical rules of professional responsibility for interpreters. So there we were with Mr. Harada, Mr. Burks, suddenly now we're in a different position. But the judge, to his credit, also looked at the defendant's letter to the court and brought those concerns into the motion to withdraw when they were questioning. And if I could just say one more thing on that, because that was a large part of what was going on in the hearing. So again, not to belabor the point, but not to bring that point up to the trial court, I just don't see the fairness in that. And also, and to a lesser extent, to the state, because we're not given a chance to then examine the error and see how, you know, the effect of that error.
Or the trial court. The trial court here had certain allegations before that were made by the defendant. about having been pressured, just go along, take the deal, 15 years. And those are the allegations or the concerns that were articulated by the defendant, and the court was trying to respond to an order. Isn't that correct?
That's correct, Chief Justice.
But if the record facially is flawed in terms of sufficiently apprising the defendant of the constitutional rights, I'm not sure what other things can be elicited off the record to supplement what's already there. I mean, in other words, the record speaks. Our law basically says that there has to be an affirmative showing on the record.
I understand that, Justice Pollack. I understand your concern, and I appreciate the responsibility this court has. It's a murder case. Like me, when I picked up the opening brief, I saw it was a motion to withdraw a guilty plea. Then I saw it was a murder trial, a murder conviction. That gets our attention maybe more than, as Justice McKenna said, harassment or disorderly. But it doesn't mean the standard changes. Now, I understand the care that the court's going to take, and I believe the court did. But it doesn't mean the standard goes from liberal allowance to automatic allowance. But maybe that's just human nature where, you know, want to go to this automatic allowance. But that's not the law, and the court's never said that. And we look at the position we're in today, coming in here, and I saw it as a colloquy issue, just because of the way the pressure issue was addressed. I mean, if you're going to say it's pressure, then call Mr. Harada ineffective. Otherwise, this is not fair. And also because I think Mr. Burks, in a way, didn't go down that avenue is because he was only asked two questions on cross-examination by Mr. Burks. And the second question, it was something about pressuring him. And Mr. Harada answered it, and then Mr. Burks sat down, and he answered it like this. If I in any way thought that my client had cold feet, I would never have gone through with this. So I guess my concern is that we raised an issue a certain way below, and I understand plain error. If you're an appellate and this attorney with any experience in this town, you understand plain error. And I, like I said, I appreciate what this court has to look at. But I would say this. Just because there's yes and no answers, I don't think is the fatal blow in a case like this. I understand we have English as a second language. I only speak English. Maybe I took French in college, so I can't really appreciate it to a full extent. But to a certain extent, I can. Sitting in a French class, hearing the French professor, I don't really always understand what he was saying. So I appreciate that. I don't want the court to think that I'm taking this position where I don't. I do. And I think also litigants may say, well, this was just a guilty plea. It's not like you went through a trial and you exerted all this effort, called witnesses, and now we're 4 to 5 years after the fact, and now you're going to have to redo it because of a deficient Tachibana colloquy. Because I have to be, in all honesty with this court, we've probably conceded before the ICA, so your honors don't see it, more deficient colloquies than we have in years combined. And I think I can speak on behalf of my colleagues, that's a bitter pill. And we agree with the court that these colloquies have got, the trial courts, got to do a better job at this. They just do. Because here we are 4 years, 5 years after the fact, and if this court's going to say, well, you know what,
Do you think your deputies, maybe I can understand that the deputies might be a little bit reluctant to address the judge, but, you know, there's really nothing that would it be helpful if one of our opinions said, you know, prosecutors are encouraged to have their own checklist to make sure that the proper colloquy is being conducted, and if not, to bring that to the judge's attention so that the judge make sure that the defendant's constitutional rights are protected.
I guess in an ideal world, Justice McKenna, anything like that helps. But the problem is, in all honesty, I don't know that, and I don't mean to impugn anyone's integrity or professionalism, but there's one legal expert in that courtroom, theoretically, and that's the trial judge. And when we're looking at the Tachibanas at the district court level, those are young attorneys right out of law school, probably many of them overwhelmed by the calendar they're handling. And I would say the same for the deputy public defenders. And I think there's the intimidation factor. I mean, I was in trials way back when. I've been doing this for 27 years. I can implore my young attorneys to prod the judge respectfully, and some have, and some have been severely admonished for doing so. So I think rather than perhaps this court imploring the trial court judges to do 1 through 10 or consider 15 through 25 when you have a salient fact like a language barrier or low intelligence, not sure that's the politically correct way to say it anymore, or someone who's just not 20 years into to law school or in the courts, that maybe it's time to require them. Because it's I think it's frustrating for we prosecutors to get to this point when it was the responsibility, and it is ultimately the responsibility of the trial judge. And I give the trial judges the benefit of the doubt. When they're in the heat of trial, those evidentiary calls are going to be difficult. Whether something has a rational basis in the evidence might be a difficult call. Whether they should do something along those lines. Those are difficult, on-the-spot decisions that they have to make. I appreciate the difficulty of that. But colloquies, those got to go right, because everybody loses at that point. I understand the court's concerns, and unless the court has any other questions, I think I've addressed what I wanted to say today. And I thank the court.
In this case, there was argument raised as far as a change of plea form, and that was done. There's no doubt about that. But ultimately, the trial court has that duty to ensure that the plea is given knowingly and voluntarily. That's under Rule 11. And so, in spite of the form, the presence of one, and the fact that Mr. Harada went over that with Mr. Kristoff, even went over it with the interpreter, the issue in this case is the colloquy.
Do you think it's irrelevant that the defendant didn't raise particular deficiencies in the colloquy? Is that relevant or irrelevant? Your analysis, it begins to sound like it's irrelevant. In other words, whether the defendant says or not, he or she was somehow misled by a deficiency in policy. Even if the defendant doesn't make that claim, nevertheless, if something was missing from the colloquy, the defendant has an absolute right to withdraw the plea. Is that your position?
Well, my position is that if something is missing from the colloquy and it does raise a question as far as whether the plea was given knowingly and voluntarily, then this court is authorized to review it.
But under your position, it really doesn't matter whether the defendant says that he or she relied on that particular, or the absence, or was somehow misled by the absence of that particular piece of information. In other words, the defendant could simply come in and say, I would like to withdraw my plea, and at that point, the court would be required to go through the colloquy and identify if any important rights were omitted from the colloquy, and at that point, the defendant would be allowed to withdraw the plea, even if they had not raised that in any way, shape, or form. Is that the rule you're arguing for?
I'm arguing it should not matter. So I don't think Mr. Kristoff was required to testify that Circuit Court didn't advise me of self-incrimination.
Well, what if it was an attorney or a judge doing the change of plea? I mean, a judge that had taken many of these pleas before and knows the constitutional rights. Are you following up on the Chief Justice's question? Should we just be saying plain error because the the judge defendant, the former judge defendant, was not asked about his or her right against self-incrimination or right to jury trial, therefore we take plain error and set aside the guilty plea? I mean, the Chief Justice is asking, should the issues be raised, should we just notice plain error in every single change of plea situation if the questions aren't asked and if the issue isn't raised? Because, you know, Solomon, it was the judge never mentioned that the defendant would have to go through sex offender treatment, and that was the issue. And it appears that some of these other cases, the defendant is raising, I didn't know this, I didn't know that. And in here, the only thing you raised was, I was pressured. And if we find that there was no pressure, are we supposed to take plain error and say, you know, he may have understood it, but we're just going to notice plain error?
Well, in this case, my position is that the court should. Mr. Kristoff in the hearing did not contest the colloquy the way that I'm contesting it now. But nevertheless, the fact that he didn't raise those issues at the time of the hearing on the motion to withdraw the plea.
But isn't aren't we supposed to be determining whether the waiver was knowing, voluntary, and intelligent? If he's not even raising the issue, how is it that we could find sua sponte that the waiver wasn't knowing, intelligent, and voluntary? He doesn't even raise the issue. He doesn't say for a moment that, hey, if you'd only told me I had a privilege, it really bothered me that I thought I might have to get up on the stand. If you had just told me the truth about that, I wouldn't have done this deal.
Right.
But he never says that.
Right, I agree, and I think there is some language that the trial court is in the best position to determine these issues.
Didn't we say in Bitovi and Solomon, it is plain error for the trial judge to accept a defendant's guilty plea without an affirmative showing that it was intelligent and voluntary? I think we've addressed this issue before.
I agree with that, and that should apply in this case too.
Anything further?
Nothing further.
Very well. Thank you to both of our attorneys here today.
Thank you.
Please rise.